Welcome to the Apologia podcast, the audio-only archive of the Apologia YouTube channel. Note that some content was designed to go with visuals, but the imagination can be a powerful thing. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider giving it a 5-star rating on the podcast app you're using now to help us reach more people. Or, since this endeavor is ad-free, consider going a step further and supporting us for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/apologia. But for now, let's get to the episode. Part of the Creation for Cash series, posted October 6, 2020, titled Hovind Sues for $500 Million, A Movie, and A Pocket Knife, featuring Robert Beatty. Welcome to Apologia, where a former Christian takes a look at the claims of Christians. That's a pretty good intro, right? So good, I hear someone else has borrowed it.
Welcome to Wacken Atheist Wednesday. Dr. Kent, the science gent, where a former evolutionist takes a look at the silly claims of evolutionists. I'm a former evolutionist, and I'm going to take a look at the silly claims of evolutionists. Former evolutionist takes a look at the stupid claims of evolutionists. For a former evolutionist, I used to be fooled by that dumb theory, takes a silly look at the claims of evolutionists. Okay, and Apologia, you have got on the wrong side, son. You need to get back on the right side.
It's been a while since I've addressed any of the claims of Kent Hovind here on my channel, but he's been talking about me over on his channel. Not my arguments or claims, mind you, but about me.
Apologia, he calls himself, a self-proclaimed Canadian atheist. Apparently he does not own, or maybe does not know how to use, a comb. Here is the cartoon Apologia uses of himself. Here is the real Apologia. Let's see, added some shoulder muscles, added pectoralis major, pectoralis minor, added biceps, you needed those, didn't you, Paul, okay? Made the big, you know, wide cheekbone so he looks tough, you know?
The eternal dilemma for wee cartoons.
I'm not bad, I'm just drawn that way.
Apologia says, or just a casino and gay bar. Apologia, you're not one of those, are you?
One of those what, Kent?
You know, one of those imaginary childhood friends.
One of those fish that cause delays.
One of those self-obsessed literary types.
One of those creatures.
One of those large enough to ride.
You mean one of those people who treat the members of the LGBTQ plus community as real human people? Absolutely I am. And then there's also this odd accusation.
And his voice. Let me play the real Apologia and then play what he sounds like when he tries to make himself sound authoritative.
And by way of proof, he played an obviously tampered on his side clip.
I just wanted to listen to his voice and then listen to the real one.
14, so we could take a look at science or history or just out our window, really.
Here's the original version.
Literal, yes, absolutely.
I mean, it's 2014, so we could take a look at science or history or just out our window, really. But movie fans always want studios to remain faithful to the source material.
Why would Kent make such a big deal and accusation about audio tampering, then use such an obviously tampered clip as evidence? I do use software to normalize volume in my videos. Sometimes there are hundreds of clips from dozens of sources. But that's not pitch-related. My reading voice is a little more deliberate than my conversational voice. But there's got to be 50 hours of me live on YouTube by now that Kent could have pulled from if his claim were accurate. For example, this conversation hosted by Kent's son, Eric.
Is it possible that God could exist?
I believe it is possible that a God could exist. I don't believe it's possible that the God of the Bible exists.
Okay.
But his real complaint seems to be this one.
I want you to listen. When I play what he does, raises the pitch so you sound more like a girl.
For the record, I don't shift pitch. But if I did, the reason that would be bad is because Kent would sound more like a girl? Sounding like a girl is a credibility problem.
What difference would it make if I sounded like this? Or if I looked like this? The merit of an idea has nothing to do with the physical attributes of the person presenting the idea. When you focus on superficial things rather than on the ideas, you come across as defensive, as admitting you have inferior ideas.
Keep your head down and you don't get whacked. It's very simple. Rachel Oates does all her stuff attacking other people's books. No matter what book you write, anybody writes a book, she'll read it and say, this is terrible, this is crummy, she's got lousy poetry, and she loves to attack other people for their books. But at least she's not promoting evolution anymore. Good job, Rachel. Keep it up. You won't get whacked if you keep your head down.
Well, I am still in the early days of my ambitious Evolution Exposed Exposed series, covering the All-Star Young Earth Creation Seminar, where all of the most respected creationists had a chance to speak. But Kent wasn't invited to that one.
His video about the other creationist groups don't like Kent Hovind. I don't care. I really don't. Maybe that's sad.
And I'm feeling a little sorry for him about that. So to be nice, I'll take his advice and not talk about evolution today. I mean, it's been a while since I made a new entry in my Creation for Cash series.
We've been going through the book that I wrote from prison, where I was unjustly incarcerated, called What on Earth is About to Happen, for Heaven's Sake. By the way, several judges have already been taken off this case. This is going to be very interesting. This is going to stir up the whole federal system, because if they overturn my case, it's going to show that what they did, well, that, I can't say too much, but believe me, pray for this case. It's in the federal court, and it's exciting what's going on.
Kent said it was going to be exciting, and I'm excited to talk about the excitement Kent might see in his case.
Robert Beatty, the longtime Kent Hovind legal and financial affairs watchdog. This is perfect.
What a mess.
But first, the most important question, the question that everyone wants to know, does my voice sound like what it normally sounds like in my video?
I noticed there was some banter about the difference in your voice. I never noticed any big difference. You know, it's not something I'd probably ever mention. Kent tried to make something out of it, and he's made fun of me as well, always calling me a moron and idiot and stuff like that. But, you know, he'll face these other people, but he won't face me.
Well, that actually leads into, what is your history with Kent Hovind? Where did this all begin as kind of a bit of a hobby mission for you?
Well, I spent over 30 years with the Internal Revenue Service, so that's one angle on the Hovind story. Kent and I are about the same age, so for as long as I was in the IRS enforcing tax laws, Kent was out preaching he's not going to obey the tax laws. So there's a professional connection there as to why I might have a passing interest in what he's up to. In the early 90s, I guess it was, a young earth creation science preacher came to my local church, caught my attention on some issues and kind of got me started. Only back then I had to write letters and type letters and send the mail and back and forth. And what little I did took a long, long time to develop. And at first, you know, I got into some science issues and tried to develop those and a perspective on them. And over time, I've done less of that and less let those who really know the issues develop that aspect of it. Mm. But you don't need to argue the science, because he's not taking the science and then working from there. He's taken the theology and conformed the science to the theology.
And for those unaware of the history, what's the overlap between the IRS and the life of Kent Hovind?
Well, Kent has, throughout his adult career, been proud of the fact that he hadn't filed any personal income tax returns when dealing with young earth creation science or the sovereign citizen movement or the anti-government movement, such as Kent Hovind is associated with. It all seems to tie together at some level, and you see this developing over time, even now as Kent has changed his end times theology, and he's looking for this tribulation, and the government's coming after him, Mark of the Beast, and chemtrails, and 5G, and all this stuff. It goes back to this perspective on the government. And so you see Kent and his people denying their citizens, denying the jurisdiction of courts, not wanting to obey the law. And that thinking in the political arena seems similar to what you can find in those who are promoting young earth creation science, in my opinion. At least in Kent's case, it works together quite well as he develops his compound down near Lenox, Alabama.
Don't call it an abandoned sandbox. He'll get upset about that.
And he lives in a sad, abandoned sandbox.
Is this a sad, abandoned sandbox? Kent Hovind lives in an abandoned sandbox. Paul, who's never been here, called it the Abandoned Sandbox. Pelogia, you've never been here. You have no idea what you're talking about. I would suggest you shut your mouth.
He's mentioned how he likes me referring to it as a compound. Some people make the mistake that I'm mispronouncing it or I misspell it, but it's deliberately referred to as a compound because there are ex-cons coming and going there, and Ken Hovind is a permanent resident and is the chief ex-con.
And eventually this attitude caught up to Kent.
Well, he's famous for bragging about not paying income tax and filing tax returns for 30 years or 28 years, I think he mentions in one particular video. And the IRS, contrary to what many believe, is slow to act and has limited resources, but they finally did tag Kent, investigated him. He was convicted in 2006, and his arrest, which he makes a lot about, as to details, perhaps to keep people from actually looking into the substance.
And by details, you mean like a SWAT raid worthy of a movie?
Right. For the few people that have paid attention, you'll notice the story changes a little bit. In the old days, you could hear people talk about how the IRS came and knocked down the doors in the middle of the night and aroused Kent and Joe out of bed and arrested them. But the facts seem to be that it was 7:30 in the morning. He's getting ready for business. His wife apparently was still in bed, but he was up and about. And because of the known affection for guns and such, the law enforcement came prepared. The SWAT team thing is something that has been stressed over the years, and I've challenged it, and nobody's actually come up with any evidence, like a lot of Kent's claims, that there was a SWAT team involved. A SWAT team is a very specific form of law enforcement activity. I think Ernie Land has even admitted implicitly it was not a SWAT team, but to the commoner, it might have appeared like a SWAT team. There was a lot of them. They came armed and prepared, and they did their job. But that's just one. I've got 68 propositions on my website that have developed over the years in dealing with Kent and list a lot of these things. The SWAT team issue is one of them. The judge's claim that she said Kent's crimes were worse than rape is another one.
And eventually Kent was tried, convicted, and sentenced.
The conviction in 2006 was for structuring employment tax issues and obstructing the federal agents in their investigation. That's what he's trying to get overturned. And he has admitted that history tells us that when preachers are guilty of such crimes or worse, that it's not good for business. So I think that has something to do with Kent refusing to admit his guilt, which is one reason why the judge was as strict on him in sentencing as she was, because that is a factor in the sentencing guidelines. Does the defendant accept responsibility for his activity? He might have got a lighter sentence had he accepted responsibility, but he didn't, and he hasn't. But that goes back to this peculiar anti-government theology he follows, like the young earth creation science stuff. They start with the theology and make the science fit. So they start with their notions about the government and then weave a fanciful tale about why they're not citizens, why they're not subject to the law, why they don't need a driver's license, and all sorts of other related antics. It's not just a matter they disagree with the law. They propose that the law is different than what is commonly understood, and unfortunately, it's not. But that's the line they take. So this current $500 million claim against the government has to do with all the bad things that was done to Kent and his current number one sovereign citizen promoter, Paul John Hansen, who hails from Omaha, Nebraska. They claim so much was done to them that they need $500 million in damages, plus the conviction should be overturned. The $500 million complaint originally starts off by Kent claiming that nothing this should give the court any notion that they have personal jurisdiction over me. And that's one of the things sovereign citizens like to deny, is the courts have jurisdiction. Over the years, can't find any merit in Kent's complaints, and so they don't go anywhere. But part of the overall theology behind the sovereign citizen anti-government people is that we don't have to win. We just have to try to overburden the system to make it collapse. And Kent's doing his part. He files lots of stuff, has filed lots of stuff over the years, over and over and over again, without success. I think he knows it's going nowhere, which is one reason why he has Paul John Hansen creating all this paperwork, is because a legitimate lawyer would no way present a case in the manner that Kent and Hansen have presented. And it goes through the courts and gets dismissed and goes nowhere. And it plays into Kent's overarching end times theology about the government's after us.
Robert, you've spent more time than anyone I know reading all of the relevant documents. So what's the crux of Kent's latest lawsuit?
Two items that come to mind. Kent has said that to understand his legal problems, you need to understand structuring. He was convicted of 45 counts of structuring in 2006. The other matter, which we might get into in a minute, is for some time now, he and Paul John Hansen have been harping on the notion that there was no verified complaint, being the special language being invoked. And so the whole conviction, the whole case falls apart. Kent likes to make the baseball analogy. If they find out you didn't touch first base, no home run.
You know, if you're playing baseball and you hit a home run and you run around and you don't touch first, they can call you out, even though you made it all the way around. You're out. You didn't touch first. They didn't touch first.
In 2006, what they did, they properly investigated Kent. They called a grand jury. The grand jury indicted him. The indictment presented the charges on which he was convicted. Kent doesn't like that. Kent says that's not legal. And that goes back to the difference I was talking about. He doesn't have to agree with it, but he lies about it in presenting this phony baloney legal sovereign citizen approach to things and claims you can't charge a man unless you have a verified complaint. And by that, he means, in effect, one of his neighbors has to swear out a complaint against him regarding some violation of the law. Well, that's not how they did it. There is no verified complaint by that definition in Kent's file. There is an indictment on which he was convicted. And after his conviction, he appealed. And the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals says, this is the way we do things in America. Mm. The indictment was just fine. And there you go. But it was not a verified complaint according to Kent's rules of law. And so he keeps harping on that. So that's what that's all about.
Gotcha.
The other was the structuring,
right?
Which goes all the way back to the beginning.
And if someone doesn't know what structuring is, what's structuring in a nutshell?
Back in 2017, Kent was on Robert Stanley's Right to Reason broadcast. And Stanley asked him, can you explain your incarceration and whether you're wearing a monitor bracelet? Kent responded,
I do not have an ankle monitor bracelet. I was incarcerated for nearly 9 years. I was given a 10-year sentence for structuring, which is one of the dumbest laws ever, and I didn't even violate it then. If you go to a website, KentHovindIsInnocent.com, there's a guy that spent 15 months researching every sentence, every line of my case, lived here in Lenox with us for 5 months, interviewed me extensively. He did this six-DVD series, Kent Hovind is Innocent, showing I did not break any laws at all. And the government actors broke probably 100 laws to put me in prison to try to shut me up. I did not break any laws, and I will maintain my innocence until I die. And then God will explain it to everybody that I didn't break any laws. But I did go to prison.
That's pretty much the standard text of what you'll hear Kent say for the last how many years without much variation. This is something else Kent has repeated 1,000 times or so over the years. Since he brings up structuring, he refers to the law, and this is what he has typically said structuring is. Structuring requires two or more transactions of $10,000 or less on the same day that total more than $10,000. That's the lie. But that's the position Kent has taken for years and years, and he's never, to my knowledge, provided a single reference to even try and back it up. That's not what structuring is about. In simple terms, the banks are required to report cash transactions of over $10,000. So if, with the intent to evade that reporting requirement, you make one or more cash transactions of under $10,000, you could be held in violation of the structuring rules. And that's what Kent did. And I'd stress here that the regulations, which have the force and effect of law, are clear that one transaction is sufficient on one day to lead to a violation of the law if the intent was to keep the bank from filing a cash transaction report. And all or most all of the 45 counts of structuring for which Kent was convicted are single transactions of just under $10,000 every 2 weeks or so.
So that's a pattern.
Yeah, there's a pattern there. If you just did it once, you know, like any other aspect of the law, there might not be a prosecution. But Kent begged people on his videos, hey, you got a problem with me not paying taxes or filing returns? Let the IRS know. Well, apparently it created some trouble for him eventually. He refers to this guy that came and lived with him for 5 months. Other times he'll talk about my paralegal, this guy or some guy. He knows who it is. Why doesn't he mention his name? It's Brady Byram, a known sovereign citizen. And he's the one that created the DVD series and all these hours and hours of this gobbledygook, which doesn't establish that Kent is innocent. Brady said that there's no such thing as structuring. And he says he proved it out of the Reines case, which is back in the 1980s. What Brady does is completely miss the point of that particular case. And to save people time, you don't have to go through the 12 hours of tedium. Reines was not accused of structuring. They had an administrative problem regarding the bank's reporting requirements, and Reines did get his conviction overturned because of all that, but it didn't have anything to do with Kent's case, and since the Reines case, they changed the law and made structuring a standalone law and fixed the problem with the reporting requirements.
$500 million is a lot of money. Was there anything in the complaint that enumerated the damages here?
Yeah, it's a number of different numbers that add up to $500 million for his time and trouble and inconvenience and punitive damages. But it's typical of what sovereign citizens do. They think their time and trouble is really valuable. And so they come up with these $500 million claims. You know, what difference does it make? They're not going to get it. And it impresses their followers.
Ah, yes. If he wants the donations to continue, he needs to feed that good versus evil, David versus Goliath narrative.
And Kent is right in the middle of that somewhere. His co-plaintiff, Paul John Hansen, even now, I checked yesterday, I didn't check today, but as of yesterday, Paul John Hansen still had a warrant for his arrest out of Nebraska for various vehicle violations. You know, he's kind of proud of the fact that he drives without a license and, I don't know, may have some kind of goofy tag on his car and no insurance, stuff like that. And you could consider him a fugitive from justice. And there he is, camped out in Lenox, Alabama with Kent, living the high life.
So that matches up with their policy at Dinosaur Adventureland, that they won't carry insurance and that if you step on their land, you know, all responsibility is on you. It's that kind of idea.
Right. That's consistent with his views on that. You enter at your own risk, and it cost one boy back in March his life, drowned, and apparently everybody thought that was just great. The parents took their dead boy home and buried him and couldn't wait to come back with the other kids that survived and built Kent a gazebo. And Kent, master at personal relationships as he is, talked the CPS people out of interviewing the parents, and the case went nowhere as far as I know. But in all that grief right after the drowning, apparently, according to reports again, Kent and the parents had no trouble getting together with a lawyer and working out some kind of deal.
And now that was filed earlier this year, as I understand it.
In May of 2020.
Right. And then there's been a number of court actions on that particular case since then.
Normally what happens, if you file a legitimate complaint, along with your complaint, you filed your request for summons. The court dockets your complaint, signs off on the summonses. You go out and serve your defendants, and then they send in their responses, and the race is on. In Kent's case, filed in May, no summonses have ever been issued. No defendants have actually been served notice. All this mumbo jumbo that Kent and Paul filed has contributed to, you know, a lot of paper shuffling. This is part of their goal, is to overburden the system. So the court has responded to Paul and Kent as to the problems with their case. And as it stands right now, there was a report and recommendation based on Kent and Paul's failure to properly respond to a previous court order, indicating the case should be dismissed, which is typical of what they file anyway. The court order they didn't obey was filed by a Judge Cannon, who in issuing an order to Kent and Paul back in June, I think it was, said, you got some problems with this case. You need to consider fixing it, and you need to respond in like 14 days. One of the defects that the judge pointed out was that three of these people appear to be immune. You can't sue them, which was the judge, the trial prosecutor, and another assistant U.S. attorney.
From the original case, from the original 2006 case?
Right.
Yeah.
And rather than do anything about that, follow the order, improve their complaint, they filed a separate federal complaint against the judge saying, how dare you tell us how many pages we need to file our complaint, and a bunch of other gobbledygook. Anyway, the court was very quick to react to that, in that the case against the judge was quickly dismissed, and the order of dismissal indicated this is frivolous. So by filing that suit and doing nothing, waiting to see what happens, they didn't meet the deadline of the order that was still outstanding. And so that's where the report and recommendation came in later, that the $500 million case be dismissed. They finally did file a third amended complaint. There was a mix-up in that it didn't get posted to the docket quite soon enough. And so that's been corrected, and the court has taken note, we kind of messed up here. So we're going to return this back to the judge and give them another opportunity to review it. I think it's academic at this point because there's nothing new going on in the case. And we've taken all that into account now, and the result's the same. There's no merit in this case. And for a variety of reasons, it's going to be dismissed. That may come this week, as far as I can tell.
Right.
As quickly as the court is responding. If not this week, maybe next week.
So that would be the final word on this case, right? That Kent doesn't have any further recourse beyond that.
Well, one of the things Kent likes to say, typical of a sovereign citizen, is it's never too late to file something. He can keep filing stuff, as frivolous as it is, if he wants to bolster his standing with his people about how he's being persecuted and raise money and fulfill his pledge. He said he's going to do this for the rest of his life. If they don't pay him off, they're not going to pay him off. So, you know, for a while there, his big push was to write to Trump. Trump's apt to pardon anybody. Look at what he's done here and there. I don't know, once this $500 million case is dismissed, I'm not sure what he might have in mind, or if he's even decided yet. He might cool it for a while.
In all the various cases you follow, just some general good advice is, if you're involved in a lawsuit, maybe don't talk about it online. Is that fair?
Well, that's what I understand most lawyers will tell you, is keep your mouth shut, criminally and civilly. I mean, the only reason I've got anything to talk about online about these things is the cases where people like to talk.
What was Kent talking about with the recused judges?
one or two of the judges did recuse themselves in the $500 million case. Judge Cannon, who issued the order and then Kent sued separately, she recused herself, you know, for obvious reasons. Not that she had to, but she did to present even the appearance of a conflict.
Right, because she was named as a defendant.
Right. Yep. And it's not uncommon in cases such as this that one of the tactics people like Kent and Paul will use is to sue the judge, kind of like shopping for a judge. Let's sue this judge. Maybe we'll get a different one, or at least we'll waste some time. It's no big deal. Kent tries to make like it's a game changer, but it's not.
So in your opinion, he's not going to be getting $500 million anytime soon from the government then?
Unfortunately not. Not even $5.
Now, a few months back, Kent tried to inject himself into a lawsuit involving his son, Eric Hovind. What was happening there?
The thing that's hard about all this is my son.
Yes.
While I was in prison, used the CSC assets and helped Ralph get this movie. It's Ralph's movie.
That's right.
And my son has taken it all away from him.
I've covered it to some extent. It's kind of interesting in that Eric Hovind and Ralph Strain were the forces behind the Genesis movie.
Genesis Paradise Lost, which my audience might remember as the subject of my Science of Paradise Lost video series.
Ralph Strain being the technical guy that really made the movie.
But Ralph is the producer and the director. Ralph, I could never make something like this that Ralph has done. It's phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. He probably wouldn't say this himself. He literally was in a room smaller than this little staging area that we've got right here in a studio, and he was in that room.
It was a janitor closet.
It was probably a janitor closet for the last 5 years. Now listen, his bed was in there. Sometimes he'd just have to, because the computers controlled his life, what they were rendering and everything. So he would sometimes be able to take a quick nap, get up, work on the computers. I mean, we're talking 16, 18, sometimes 20 hours a day before being able to rest even for an extended period of time, 4 or 5 years.
Then they had some kind of falling out over how the movie was to be marketed and who owned it and all this sort of stuff. And there's a federal lawsuit pending with the potential of settlement. And for a long time, people are aware that Kent has had this chip on his shoulder about how Eric supposedly stole the ministry from him.
It's our position at CSC that Eric illegally transferred all the CSC assets that had been entrusted to him November 2nd, 2006, the day I was taken to jail. Son, the solution is very simple. We trusted you with a bunch of stuff that the government did not seize. The forklift, my Swiss Army knife, my underwear. We would like that back. That's all.
And for some reason, not really clear, Kent got the notion that now that Eric is in this legal dispute with Ralph about all this ministry stuff, that's my inside track to get what I want out of Eric. I don't know what he's thinking. I think he might have mentioned earlier about trying to intervene in that suit, which he has not done. That suit doesn't have anything about Kent Hovind in it, as far as I can tell. And so I think that was just some kind of pipe dream or ploy or something to suggest to his followers that he might have an opening to get back at Eric. If he doesn't get what he wants out of Eric, maybe ruin that case for him by helping Ralph or something, some form or fashion. I just don't know. It's a crazy situation.
So going back to the original beef between father and son, when Kent went to prison, he left Eric in charge of the ministry assets. Now, if Eric's side of the story is to be believed, the only way he could prevent some of these assets from being seized by the government was to create a new ministry and quickly sell the assets to this new ministry. From where I sit, this was a shrewd legal maneuver on Eric's part to protect the family.
The government never would have seized my pocket knife.
I sold any assets that the government did not come after. Didn't transfer any bank accounts. The government did end up coming and seizing bank accounts. So I transferred any assets the government didn't have an interest in at that time to a nonprofit organization, GodQuest. Mm-hmm. 2 years later, 2009, the judge says, there is no CSC, everything belongs to Kent Hovind. If I would have not have done that transition, they would come take this table.
they would come take these chairs. They would have the rights to take everything.
Now, the reason that Kent and Paul John Hansen...
And I'm going to have to get Paul, who is one of the trustees, on the phone here. Let's see.
Yes, the same Paul Hansen, who's Kent's co-plaintiff in the new $500 million lawsuit. The reason they don't take Eric to court is that Eric didn't do anything illegal. Of course, with Kent and Paul's sovereign citizen ideas, they just don't recognize legal rulings that they don't like.
Now, a federal court said the creation science evangelism doesn't exist, but the federal court doesn't have any jurisdiction over such property. The federal judges say a lot of things.
And so Kent must resort to adjudicating his family drama in the court of public opinion, looking for his army of followers to harass Eric's friends to shame Eric.
I'd like you to call Pastor Traylor. I called and asked him, would you please intercede? One of your church members needs to be rebuked. I think they need to get a bunch of phone calls, and the pastor needs to get a bunch of phone calls.
Now, I leave it as an exercise for you to decide for yourself if Eric's actions in not returning everything to his father is unethical, or if perhaps this is small potatoes compared to the damage Kent did to Eric's mom and the family as a whole. But ethical or slimy, Eric's actions were within the law. And that theme carries over to Eric's lawsuit with Ralph Strain. Back around 2009, Eric and Ralph and Resurrection Pictures created an LLC corporation called Genesis Movie LLC to produce what eventually became Genesis Paradise Lost. It's pretty standard practice in the film industry to create such LLCs for individual film projects. Ralph brought to the table primarily his animation labor, and Eric was to supply funds. Now, when any person creates something, a painting, a poem, a paragraph, whatever, the default in Western law is typically that the creator holds the copyright to that work, even if they're paid to do it. That's why creative employees and contractors are asked to sign work-for-hire contracts, which specifically assigns rights to the creative output to the company. I've dealt with at least 100 such contracts in my life, spanning different industries. They're an incredibly standard thing. Per the court filings in this case, Ralph signed and agreed up front that all his efforts would be work-for-hire with copyright assigned to Genesis Movie LLC. Now, here's the important admission by Kent's friend Paul Abramson.
I told Ralph, I'm getting a sword and I'm going to stand right in front of you and let me engage him. Because he's very much of a creative person. He's not a guy to be out in front. He knows I say this about him. I'm not saying this behind his back. But this idea of a lawsuit, of business and some of these things are not his forte.
It wouldn't surprise me at all to learn that Ralph didn't, and maybe still doesn't, understand what he signed. With the film completed and Eric and Ralph not seeing eye to eye about how the film should be distributed, Ralph decided to go off on his own and make a sequel to that movie. Now, it's a very rare circumstance that a director of a movie can just go off and make a sequel to a movie without involving the original production partners. Brad Bird conceived of, wrote, and directed The Incredibles, but he can't just go off and make an Incredibles 3 without Pixar, now Disney. Ridley Scott conceived of, wrote, and directed Alien, but when he has ideas for sequels, he can't just go off and make them without involving Fox, now Disney. Everything's Disney. And so, too, Ralph has no legal rights to make a sequel, no matter how much of his life he poured into the original, no matter how little Eric contributed to the end product. Though he did raise about $1 million to pay for the production, per the filings. Longtime viewers may recall that this was pretty much crowdfunded from well-meaning Christians, who never got anything back, but that's a different story. To compound Ralph's legal missteps, he also started selling digital copies of Genesis Paradise Lost, something he was not authorized to do, again, no matter how much work he put into it. If you want to argue that a more shrewd Eric took advantage of poor Ralph, that's one thing. Though I've read the documents, and there's not really anything in the agreement that isn't incredibly standard for Hollywood deals that I myself have signed. Your own internal sense of fairness might say that Eric acted unethically in securing an oppressive contract. Fine. But in my non-expert opinion, Ralph is definitely in breach of the contract, oppressive or not. There's a saying in film and TV, it's not about what you're worth, it's about what you can negotiate. Ralph didn't negotiate, and I hope that in the future he gets an agent and an entertainment lawyer to look over his contracts. And while I'm dishing out unsolicited advice, notice that at no point has Eric gone public on this suit, attempting to win over public opinion. Ralph tried, to his own legal detriment, but just provided further fodder in the case against him. Kent tried the same thing, but Eric has kept his mouth shut, and in the end will be rewarded with legal high ground in both cases, even if you argue that he lost the moral or ethical high ground.
I have the high ground!
As Nate the lawyer says,
I'm not saying this was right. I'm just saying, was it legal, lawful, or unlawful? And I think here you're right. I think it was lawful, but it could also be immoral, because law and morality aren't cousins. They are separate things.
If you're in a lawsuit, don't talk about it on social media. So says me, for what it's worth. It seems that this one's going to be settled out of court without the involvement of Kent. Either way, I'm personally excited about a lack of a sequel to a movie that was so dishonestly misleading about science from beginning to end.
Something else Kent does not like to talk about is that while that was all going on, there was also a civil investigation as to his personal income taxes. The criminal case involved employment taxes, the structuring, and obstruction, all of which he was convicted of. That doesn't say anything about his personal income taxes, which he bragged about not having filed returns on for 28 years. That case was investigated. The IRS made a proposal. The case went to U.S. tax court civilly, was decided against Kent, went to appeals. Kent lost that. And that case involved like 10 years worth of tax returns and tax liabilities, $3.5 million or so worth of personal income tax and penalties, not to count the interest for all those years, probably as much as $10 million now with interest or more. Kent doesn't like to talk about that. He just likes to tell you he pays all the taxes he owes, suggesting he doesn't owe personal income tax because he's got some goofy notions about that consistent with his sovereign citizen, anti-government, anti-tax beliefs. But there's millions sitting there in the accounts waiting to be paid if he ever gets around to paying it.
It's a good reminder that despite these shows and claims about poverty, there are literally millions of dollars tied up in these Hoven ministries.
Well, fortunately for him, he was able to get Ernie to set up this tax-exempt organization, which in the beginning had to file Form 990s and tell the government how much money they took in and spent. But then they decided they were going to call themselves a church, and the IRS, for whatever reason, said, okay. And changing over to a church, they don't have to tell anybody anything. And in days gone by, Ernie has bragged that Kent had people with millions of dollars ready to help finance him when he gets out of prison. So there's no way to tell what's really going on with the money. But he certainly, it's impressive what he's done since he's got out on that sandbox near Lenox, Alabama.
One guy who claims to be an atheist said this is an abandoned sandbox.
If people are interested in following the end of this case and any future cases involving this, I know you're tracking this online. Where can people find your work tracking these cases?
Well, I've got a Facebook group called Kent Hoven's Worst Nightmare. Some people have criticized me for that title, not understanding that it's a takeoff from Kent's own biography, which was titled Kent Hoven, the Atheist's Worst Nightmare. So that's the Facebook group, Kent Hoven's Worst Nightmare. I've talked to various people suggesting they try to get Kent to meet with me on their program or in some venue, and Kent just won't do it, and he won't send out a champion. We could really have a nice talk. We could take one issue at a time and have equal time.
I get half the time. And we talk about one topic at a time.
And actually resolve some of these fundamental issues. The other is a website called Kent Hovind V, as in versus Robert Beatty, The Great Debates. So lots of material on both those sites.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing your Hovind insights with us today.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for watching. With special thanks to my patrons, without whom my work on this channel couldn't carry on. If you're willing and able to join them, please find the links in the description.
Okay, how do I get out of here?
Robert, you should know by now, we never get out of here.
So you skeptics and scoffers, shut up. I didn't break any laws.